Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're continuing our series on what we're calling halachic men, or man, as the case is, but it's probably men. And we've spoken about the Rif already, and we spoke about the Rush, and tonight I want to begin speaking about the Rambam. Now, I have great difficulty putting this together because there's just so much information. I work much better when you have a small, discrete topic, and I can feel like I get to the bottom of it. When the topic is unbelievably massive, and I feel like I don't know where to start, where to stop, I don't know what to do. The book that I used most was Professor Isidore Twersky of Harvard. He's the son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik. He wrote a book called Introduction to the Code of Maimonides. This is Professor Twersky's book. I used it extensively for tonight, although I have to admit that he writes like a Soloveitchik, even though he wasn't, which means every sentence is so dense and so complex that I fell asleep many times preparing, and I don't know if I came up with anything, but we'll do the best we can to talk about who the Rambam was and the effects that this had on the Rambam that we'll look at as a halachist. It's possible to look at the Rambam with many different lenses. You can view the Rambam as a great philosopher.
A doctor.
Right? You can view the Rambam as a great philosopher in terms of the Mora and the Buchamitzer. You can view the Rambam, like you said, as a doctor. We'll see the Rambam was the doctor in the court in Cairo.
Yes.
He's like the chief doctor.
Yes.
He wrote many works on medicine. You could view the Rambam as a communal leader. The Rambam had the official title. He was the Nagid. He was the leader of the community. We are going to look at the Rambam as not just a rabbi, but as a halachist. In other words, even within the Rambam, the rabbi, there is the Rambam, the rabbi, who's a commentator. Right? And that's like the Rambam of the Perush HaMishnah, the Rambam of the Perush on the three Siddarim of Shas, which is not extant. The Rambam tells us that he wrote a commentary on the Gemara, on three Siddarim, on Moed Nashim and Nezikin. We don't have it. We have a little bit on Shabbos. It was published not so long ago. The Jewish Theological Seminary of America published some of it. We have a little bit, not much. So the Rambam is a commentator. The Rambam also has works that are not extant. The Rambam wrote a work of his glosses on the Rif. We don't have that either. I want to look at the Rambam, though, and what we'll do probably more next week than this week, is the Rambam as a halachist. But to get into it, let's just talk about the Rambam's biography a teeny bit. Okay? Rambam is born in, 1135. Well, we're 1138. Okay, and he dies in Egypt in 1204. Okay, that's the basic timeline of the Rambam. The Rambam goes through what's called the Almohad invasion. There are these group of Berbers, and they come, and first they take over northern Algeria.
Okay.
And then they move on. They begin in 1120 and they move on to Spain. They conquer Cordova, Spain, where the Rambam is from. They conquer that in 1161. The Almohads are what we would call religious fanatics. And as religious fanatics, they don't want to tolerate any other religions. Take a step back. Traditionally, Jews liked being in Islamic countries more than being in Christian countries. The reason is that under Islam, we had an official protected legal status called Dhimmi, D-H-M-M-I. Dhimmi means that we are like second-class citizens. If we pay taxes, all is good. So you know what? If you live in Islamic world, things are grand. However, there's a thing, people talk about it a lot today, called radical Islam. Radical Islam was not invented around the year 2000. Radical Islam existed long beforehand. And radical Islam comes, and they basically say, my way or the highway, and if you don't agree with our vision of the world,
off with your head.
Off with your head.
This is to the fellow Muslims.
What?
They're saying this to their fellow
Muslims. To the non-Muslims. Right. Even to fellow Muslims. Right? Muslim, you don't agree with us, you're gone. And alachas kama v'kama tova mechupelas l'mokom aleinu, if a Jew. Now, what happened as follows. What happened is that after the Almohads take over, there were two schools of Jews. Some Jews began living a Marano existence.
Okay.
They began to hide their Jewishness. The Rambam and his family, however, ran away. First, they run to Fez, Morocco. Just interesting side note, we know the Rambam spent time in Fez. The Rif, who's Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, probably did not spend any time in Fez. Right? Who knows? But the Rambam goes to Fez, Morocco. He's running around a lot. He's moving from place to place. Once he's in Fez, so the Almohads attack Fez also. He runs to Egypt via Eretz Yisrael, via Akko. The Rambam spends a little bit of time in Eretz Yisrael. When he's in Eretz Yisrael, we know the Rambam davens at the Har HaBayis one time. I don't know if this means that he would write for, that he would vote for any particular Israeli political party. Probably not. Okay? But
who is ruling Israel at the time?
Who is ruling Israel at the time? Muslims. Yeah. What? This is before the Ottomans. Right? This is before the Ottomans. This is their various Islamic groups. Actually, the truth is they're a Christian. I'm sorry. This is there are Christians who are ruling Israel. This is after the Crusades, thank you. There are Christians who are ruling Israel. In fact, one of the stories about the Rambam that they have over here, again, as you know, this all comes from Wikipedia, which is whatever. Here, at the top of page 2, Maimani shortly thereafter was instrumental in helping rescue Jews taken captive during the Christian king, whatever, siege of the Egyptian town, whatever. He sent 5 letters to the Jewish communities in Lower Egypt, asking them to pool money together to pay ransom. The money was collected and then given to 2 judges sent to Palestine to negotiate with the Crusaders. The captives are released. Right? And according to Goldstein, they quote over here, that was one of the communal leadership positions that the Rambam occupied, which led to the Rambam becoming becoming the Nagid, becoming the leader of the community. Okay, Rambam is an extraordinary person. He is well-read in everything. By his own admission, he says, I read all the books of philosophy, science, and religion. Now, what the heck that means, I don't know, but it means a lot more, right, than someone who didn't read any books. Okay. Right, so, or read books while he's falling asleep. So the Rambam is just extraordinary. Now the Rambam is supported in his early life, and early life means probably until his 40s, by his brother. The Rambam's brother is a businessman. And they tell a story over here that the Rambam encouraged his brother to buy goods in Sudan. He doesn't like it in Sudan, so he goes to India. And then the Rambam's brother is on the ship and capsizes and he dies. And the Rambam is awfully bad. He feels terrible about this. Because my bro, who was my protector, who is supporting me. Now, by the way, take a step back. The Rambam writes in Halacha that you are not supposed to be supported to learn Torah. Well, maybe he was supported by his brother, not only to learn Torah, but to read every single book on the planet. I don't know, but facts are the Rambam was supported. Julian.
Was his brother married?
Yes, his brother was married, but left over one daughter who the Rambam himself took care of.
The estate went to the daughter.
So this, all the money was lost, apparently, on the boat.
Oh,
again, it's all befarish here in... This is here. Read on page 2.
Yeah.
The Maimonides family, hoping to increase their wealth, gave the savings to the brother, the youngest son, David ben Maimon, who's a merchant. He's supposed to go stuff only at the Sudanese port, blah, blah. He ends up in India, and he dies. Okay? That's basically the story in a nutshell. So, the money is lost. Money is lost. The Rambam realizes he has to get a job. And like any good Jewish boy, he becomes a doctor. And his fame spreads. And he becomes known as the greatest doctor, and he becomes the doctor to the Sultan, etc., and that's the story. Now, a few things to be said about the Rambam. He's running around a lot, point one. Point two is we have absolutely no idea when the Rambam really learned Torah. Mm. Right? Who was the Rambam's teacher of Torah? Well, his father, Maimon. And Maimon himself is a student of the Rima Gash. That we know. Did the Rambam ever go to yeshiva? Absolutely not. By the way, most of the great leaders, okay, I hope I don't get fired from my job in YU for saying this, but most of the great leaders of the Jewish people forever have not studied in yeshiva.
Yeah.
Right? If you are a really impressive person, you do it on your own. Right? You don't go to yeshiva. Well, the Rambam kind of learns with his father. We don't know exactly, but he learns at a young age. Again, if his brother died between 1169 and 1177, he's born in 1135. So the Rambam's what, 64? Is 34. So when his brother dies, now 35. That's okay. That's the story of the Rambam. So he moves around a lot. He's supported by his brother. He becomes a doctor. He rises in fame, and the rest is history. Now, what type of life did the Rambam live? So let's just read here at the bottom of page 2, right after note 37. In a famous letter, this letter, by the way, is written to one of the Ibn Tibbans. Okay, let's just take a step back. The Rambam wrote some of his books in Arabic. And the books are popular. The Mora Nevuchet, written in Arabic. And because it's a popular book, they want it translated. The Rambam himself hires one of the Ibn Tibbans to translate his book. Okay? So Ibn Tibbin, right? My kids always find that name like so funny when I talk about Ibn Tibbin, but whatever. Ibn Tibbin translates the Mora Nevuchim for the Rambam, and he says, "Hey, dear Maimonides, I'm working on this translation. It's not so simple. Can I come and spend time with you so that I do a better job of the translation?" Right? You spend time with the author. What did you mean with that? What did you mean? Right? You could get more information. So the Rambam writes, "You know what? Don't come. Don't come to me. Not that I don't want you. Of course I want you. But there's no time. Right? There's no time for you to spend time." So note 37 and following. In a famous letter, Maimonides describes his daily routine. After visiting the Sultan's palace, he'd arrive home exhausted and hungry. The letter actually says he's arriving home around an hour after noon. He is exhausted. He's hungry. "I'd find the antechamber filled with Jews and Gentiles. I'd go to heal them and write prescriptions for their illness until the evening. I'd be extremely weak." Okay? Now they're cutting out some of the most important parts of the letter. The letter says that the Rambam doesn't have time to eat. He asks permission from the people waiting for his prescriptions right when he gets there. "Can I eat?" He eats like a quick bite. He deals with them the whole day, writing their prescriptions, healing their various illnesses. Sometimes he's called back to the palace to treat the Sultan's harem, right? The Rambam is a busy guy. The Rambam writes the best part of this letter, which Tversky quotes, and he doesn't quote in Wikipedia, is that he's so tired at the end of the day, they throw him on his horse, and they send him home. He's like, right? He's thrown on the horse to go home. What happens when he gets home? All the Jewish people there to ask him shilas. When on earth does this man have time for anything? That's the Rambam's life. The man is unbelievably busy. Now, the only reason why this is funny is when you think about it, the Rambam is probably the greatest champion of a life of solace and quietude, a life of relaxation, sitting by the pool, thinking deep thoughts, and drinking martinis. I don't know. Right? That's what the Rambam describes. And not only does the Rambam describe it, but the Rambam writes that the way to master knowledge and the way to really understand the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is a necessary criteria to get into Olam Haba. For the Rambam, if you don't master certain thoughts, you don't, the gates don't open, you don't get in. And you need that type of lifestyle to get in. But the Rambam lived the farthest thing from that lifestyle. Let's kind of read a little bit in the Rambam itself.
He must have had some time before his brother died.
So probably before his brother died, he had some of that. He was a vociferous reader. He's a writer. I don't know how much time the Rambam... Remember, if he finishes the commentary on Mishnah at the age of 33, which is right before his brother died, and then he's writing, that was his first work. He's writing all of his other works after his brother is dead. So what is going on here? Either there's some hyperbole, or the man didn't sleep, and after answering the shaylas from all the people lined up, after writing the prescriptions for everybody, he sits down and he cracks open his Gemara and he writes, right, all night. I don't know.
His brother died, he had to become a doctor to make a living. What was the requirement? You have to go 4 years to medical school?
Have absolutely no idea. I don't know. Again, I'm just...
Why didn't he like an apprenticeship?
Here, I mean, I'm just reading from Wikipedia, page 2, the paragraph that begins around 1171. With the loss of the family funds tied to David's business venture, Maimonides assumed the vocation of a physician, for which he was to become famous. I guess so, I don't know. By the way, the Rambam is not only famous in Jewish tradition. The Rambam is famous in Islamic tradition as well. The Rambam is famous in Christian tradition. St. Thomas Aquinas quotes Maimonides. He got many, oh no, many, he got a lot, some of his ideas from Maimonides. We have to like downgrade as the sentence goes on. The Rambam was well known in Islam, so much so that Muslims claimed the Rambam for themselves. Let me explain. When I was taking a course in graduate school, so I took a course in Islamic Jewish culture with Professor Paul Fenton from the Sorbonne. So for... From the Sorbonne in France. He was teaching in YU one summer semester. It was a very productive course, actually. So one of the things that he assigned to us was that we should look up some of the great Jewish figures in the Encyclopedia of Islam. See what they say about him. Mm. So the Encyclopedia of Islam has very lengthy discussions of Reb Sadigo and then the Rambam. Mm. And they give a whole tradition that the Rambam converted to Islam. Wow. They want him. Right? I don't know. I wasn't there. But the point is... the point is that there is a strong desire to take the Rambam as their own. And that desire, by the way, exists for every Jewish person as well. The Rambam is like a mirror that we look into. So if I want to study Torah one way, I say, oh, I'm like the Rambam. I want to study Mada, I'm like the Rambam. I want to, whatever you want, the Rambam and the Vilna Gaon are like the two mirrors that everyone projects themselves onto. You know, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. How many high schools are named Rambam? And how many basketball... You think the Rambam really played basketball? I don't know. I doubt it. Right? But the basic point is that the Rambam is exceedingly busy, even though he is the biggest champion of a life of quiet, solitude, etc. Let's make a few points, though. In terms of the books that the Rambam writes, we'll talk about this a little more. We spoke about the commentary on the Mishnah. That book is written in Arabic. The Rambam, though, then moves from the commentary of the Mishnah. He writes a Sefer HaMitzvos, and he writes the Mishnah Torah. Sefer HaMitzvos is like the introduction to Mishnah Torah. Sefer HaMitzvos gives us a list of 613 mitzvos. And the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam is commenting on those 613 mitzvahs. That's what it's doing. Now,
a little bit more than just
it lists the mitzvahs, explains them a bit, and then the Rambam elaborates on it in the in the Yad HaChazakah. Now, a few points to be made. The change, the shift in the Rambam from writing in Arabic to writing in Hebrew. What does that mean? Now, we can ask the question the other direction also. Why would a major figure like the Rambam write in Arabic to begin with? Are Jewish books traditionally written in Arabic?
No.
Not so many, although Reb Saadia wrote in Arabic. People around could read it. The Rambam is fixed in the culture where he feels that people might not have the proficiency in the Hebrew, so I'm going to write in Arabic to get to them. But there is a drawback. If you write in Arabic, you can only write to this part of the world. If you want to influence the Christian part of the world, for lack of a better term, you can't write in Arabic. So the... what?
Greek, Latin.
Greek, Latin. The Rambam actually read Greek. I don't know if the Rambam read Latin. Did he know German? I haven't got the foggiest idea.
Hebrew, because that's the
so you write in Hebrew. Hebrew is... what? For the Ashkenazic Jews, they probably knew Hebrew. I don't know if the Rambam knew German.
Was German even extended?
Was German a language? Yeah.
I mean, it was
certainly
very different, probably.
But here's the thing. So the Rambam changes from writing in Arabic to writing in Hebrew, which at the one time increases his reach. On the other hand, it also limits the Rambam because not as many people could read Hebrew. Hebrew is for the intelligent people. But the Rambam made a conscious choice. And that choice is the type of Hebrew he writes in. Hebrew is many different languages. No? You have Biblical Hebrew. You have Mishnaic Hebrew. You have what's called Rabbinic Hebrew, which involves a lot of Aramaic. Hebrew 1, Biblical Hebrew, is a difficult language, and it's also not such a rich language. You don't have that many verb forms, you have fewer words in Biblical Hebrew. You use the same shorish again and again. Rabbinic Hebrew, in the sense of Mishnaic Hebrew, is a much richer language. So the Rambam makes a decision. He's influencing a larger group, but he doesn't want to lose people who otherwise might not get it, so he writes in a simple Hebrew, Mishnaic Hebrew. Hence, the Rambam tells us his book is called Mishnah Torah. Mishnah, meaning I'm writing in the language of the Mishnah. Right? That's what the Rambam does, Mishnah Torah. There is Chaim Chernovitz, Rav Tzadir, however, has a different take. Again, it's probably also correct as to why the Rambam chose this particular type of Hebrew. And Chernovitz argues that one of the major themes of the Rambam is to remove from the Jewish constellation certain, what we'll call, for lack of a better term, kfiridic ideas. So the Rambam argues vociferously against a god who has any physical form. No? This is something that he's going against a very significant part of the Jewish world who at that time were entertaining ideas that God is corporeal. Okay, got it. That's one part of the Rambam. That's the Rambam, the philosopher. And the Rambam also has this thing that Tversky deals with extensively that he tries to make philosophy into halacha. Things that we would not include in a halachic text, the Rambam finds ways of stuffing it in there. Right? Philosophy and halacha is going to be connected. So therefore, you're not bequemous if you believe this. Right? Got it. Rambam makes it, instead of philosophical construct, it's now a halachic construct.
Could you give us an example?
What?
Could you give us an example of that kind of...
So the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva speaks about the following people are called Minim, the following people don't have a chek and don't have a. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Deis at length. All of the principles of faith which the Rambam first outlined in the Perish HaMishnah in Sanhedrin, the Rambam, which is a philosophical work, the Rambam decides to make halakhic. Right? This, by the way, is what gives people, pardon the expression, the bludgeon with which to bludgeon others. Because once Epicurus is not just a philosophical construct, it's now a halakhic construct, so now we could have people make langa birds and say, Zogin, and there's an Epicurus, and see, it's not Epicurus, I'm an Alizane an Epicurus. No? That's halakhic. That's what the Rambam does. Okay? You can only say it in Yiddish, or else it like loses the whole thing. So that's point one. But the Rambam is also trying to uproot the carrots. When the Rambam moves to Cairo, the majority of the Jews in town are carrot. Mm. Now, the carrots were a large movement. The carrots have their own halachic literature. Now you can say, halacha, carrots, aren't these supposed to be only into Torah Shabbat? The answer is, there's no way of living. I don't know if any of you read that book, The Year of Living Biblically. It actually features someone from a neighborhood, Berkowitz, Aleph HaShalom, the Shatner's guy.
Yes.
Right?
Oh,
right.
Yes,
yes. What about, how does this relate to Berkowitz?
So it relates to Berkowitz because The Year of Living Biblically is kind of a joke book in that you can't really live life just based on the Bible.
Well,
it's a very difficult way to live life, and the Karaites face this difficulty. Because if I want to live life just based on Vos Shteit in Scripture, nothing else, life is difficult. You need some sort of Torah Sheba'al Peh. So the Karaites put together their own Torah Sheba'al Peh. Right? Starting with Anan ben David, 9th century, they developed an entire Torah Sheba'al Peh. And that's a whole Karaite thing. It's funny, the main scholar of Karaitism is named Leon Nimoy. Whenever I hear that name, I like think about Star Trek. No,
yes.
What?
Yeah,
from the same.
I assume so. Although, what's his name? Nimoy from Star Trek is supposed to be a descendant of the Vilna Gaon.
Yeah,
that's right. But the girl wasn't a Kohen. I don't know. So the point is,
maybe it's from his mom's side.
What?
It's from his mom's side. I don't know. Anyway.
But let's move right along. So the Rambam is opposed to Karaites. Karaites have their own Torah Sheba'al Peh. But the Karaite Torah Sheba'al Peh is written in Biblical Hebrew. Because that's all the Karaites really believe in. And what that does is it means that it's really hard for the common man, Allah has become the common woman, to access the text because it's a difficult language. The Rambam, in an effort to influence and overturn the Karaites, the Rambam writes Mishnayic Hebrew, which is easier to read. That's Chaim Chernovitz's argument. And then Chaim Chernovitz goes a step further. He says, you know what? The fact that the Rambam writes the Perush HaMishnah, the fact that the Rambam writes, the Mishnah Torah, based on the Sefer HaMitzvos, that itself is a very anti-Karaite move. What the Rambam is doing is he's saying, I'm not just writing halacha. You Karaites, you accuse us Rabbinites of being unconnected to the biblical text. Well, fool on you. We're not unconnected to the biblical text. My halachic work is based on a Sefer HaMitzvos. And the Rambam all the time tries to find a textual, scriptural basis for a halacha. Right? That is anti-Karaite. That's already interesting. The Rambam, in note 159 in Twersky's book, he gives you probably 20 different examples of where the Rambam tells us things which are clearly anti-Karaite. Just to give you a few of them, these are the ones that Rav Shechter always quotes, actually. The Rambam writes that there are three ways to be Mekadesh a woman. Right? You can get married with three forms, three mechanisms. Kesef, Shtar, and Diyah. Now, it's a Mishnah, first Mishnah in Kedushin, well known. How do we do Kedushin? We all do Kedushin with Kesef. We don't write a shtar, and we don't do kedushin with bia. We don't do kedushin with bia. The Gemara says it's not sneistik. Gotcha. Understood. Right? Why don't we do kedushin with the shtar? Why do we do kedushin with kestev? So the answer is that the karets would do kedushin with shtar. And they do kedushin with shtar because shtar is mentioned in the Torah in the context of a get, and they therefore derive kedushin. Also, wonderful, great. They would do kedushin with shtar. They would never use kesef for kedushin because the Gemara derives kesef kedushin based on kicha kicha mistei Ephron gezeira shavas. A gezeira shava is a rabbinic derivation, something that the Karaites would never agree to. To show that the Karaites are wrong, we always use kesef for kedushin, right? There are a number of the Karaites would always do bris mila with rocks, because there's a scripture, there's a pasuk, and Sipora takes a rock and she cuts off the arla of her son, right? So that's how you do a mila, with a rock. Our tradition is, when was the last time you saw a male use a rock?
How did Avram do it?
But
I'm saying maybe he did it with a rock.
They had metal at their time already. It's past the Bronze Age. Right? Well, okay, whatever. It's a question. The Torah seems to say they had metal. Right? It's clear in the Torah that there is metal. We do mila with knives. Why? Well, the Karaites didn't. We want to show, right? And this is the way Rav Shetter quotes from Rav Soloveitchik, and there's a number of Rambams where the Rambam goes out of his way to tell us the minhag, even though that's not a common thing for the Rambam. The Rambam says the minhag is that we do kedushei kesef. The minhag is we use a knife for mila. Why is he going out of his way? To show us, boop! Right? Take those carrots, boop! Right? That's what the Rambam is trying to do. Now, part of the anti-Karaic thing, Chaim Soloveitchik notes that the Rambam's order in Hilchos Shabbos makes absolutely no sense. The Rambam begins by giving us rules. Davar Shemus Gabim, Psik Reisha, that makes a lot of sense. That's Perek Aleph for Shabbos. Perek Beis of Shabbos, the Rambam is talking about Pekuach Nefesh. Okay, got it, that makes sense. Then suddenly the Rambam gets into Hadlokas Neiros on Shabbos. And Amira L'Nochri. These are Dinim Terabbanon. And then after those Dinim Derabbanan, does the Rambam go and talk about the Malachos? So everyone, people don't think about these questions because people don't view Rambam like there's a structure to it. But it's a little bit strange. Chapters 1 and 2 of Maimonides is what you'd expect, no? You'd expect to begin with general rules. Pekuach Nefesh shows the severity of Shabbos. And then I'd expect to tell me, okay, these are the 49 categories of labor. Yet the Rambam doesn't do that. Right afterwards, the Rambam talks about Hadlokas Neiros Shabbos and Amira L'Nochri. Why? Says Professor Soloveitchik, because you have to read the Rambam as an anti-Karaite polemic. So the Rambam, wow! So the Rambam is telling me the halachos that the Karaites don't hold up. Karaites don't light candles before Shabbos. Because it says in Scripture, so one of the true signs of Rabbinate Jews was Hadlokas Neiros. By the way, the Rambam also, right at the beginning of Hilchos Shabbos, talks about the din of Shehiyah and HaChazara, the din of how you keep food warm on Shabbos. You know why? Because Karaites ate cold cuts on Shabbos lunch. They didn't have cholent, those bums, right? To eat cold cuts. Rachman al Tzlan. That's Karaite Judaism. Right? So the Rambam,
they had room temperature cuts.
Oh, that's
or outside.
That's much worse than anything I can imagine.
Air temperature
cuts.
What?
Matzo ball soup. There's no hot food. You can't have hot food on Shabbos if you're a Karaite.
Yeah,
but the point is, the Rambam is beginning Hilchos Shabbos and Amira L'Nochri. Karaites hold that you are not allowed to instruct a non-Jew to do anything for you on Shabbos, because the Torah formulates the prohibitions on Shabbos in the passive voice, kol melacha lo ye'aseh, and therefore it can't be done. And don't instruct any non-Jew to do anything for you on Shabbos. The Rambam in his, boom, to the Karaites, the Rambam includes all of this right beginning Hilchos Shabbos. So the approach of Mishneh Torah of the Rambam being an anti-Karaite text is actually there's something to it. Chaim Chernovitz writes about this at length, and we quoted. Fine. Let's just talk about two more points. It's getting late. Why did the Rambam write Mishneh Torah? Why did he write it? So, the Rambam, his introduction to Sefer HaMitzvos, and we already noted that Sefer HaMitzvos is the introduction to Mishneh Torah. Let's just go through this very quickly. Amar HaRav HaGadol Maranav Rabbana Moshe Evan HaLokim. Slowly. Who's writing this? The Rambam. And the Rambam is writing, says Moses the servant of God. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Usually when you write an introduction to your work, you write something that, I am the most humble of your servants. I am a simpleton. I was only blessed by... You usually don't write an introduction to your work, right? The great rabbi says. Right? Talking about it himself. This is not a meek introduction. The Rambam writes that I am going to write all of the rules of the Torah so that nothing is missing. And, right, the Rambam writes the part that I mentioned earlier, I'm not going to compose it in Talmudic language because people won't understand it if I write it that way. Right? Aval achabreu b'lashon ha-mishnah kedei shiakel zeh l'rov ha-nashim. I'll write it in the language of the Mishnah. Yeah, I should have underlined this part also. Right before the end of this paragraph, right before this paragraph break. U'bichlal, shelo yitzareich imo achar ha-Torah, sefer acher zulato. The reason I'm writing this book is so that you will not need any other book besides the Torah, besides Torah Shebikhtav. The only book that you'll need is this book. Right, ladat mimenu davar mimashi yitzareich b'chol ha-Torah bein midoraisa bein midrabanan. I'm writing this book, so this is the only book that you need. You see our library over here?
Yes.
You don't need any of it. All you need is this little shelf of Maimonides and the Chumash. That's okay, maybe Tanakh. Right? That's all you need. That's all you need. Now, by the way, many feel that the reason why traditionally we don't call the book the Mishneh Torah, which is the way the Rambam called it, instead we call it the Yad HaChazakah. Yad stands for 14. There are 14 books that the Rambam wrote. Mishneh Torah is too pompous a title. Mishneh Torah, the repetition, the synopsis of all of learning. Well, that's what the Rambam felt it was. The Rambam's intention, and this is a bit of a debate among the scholars, did the Rambam intend to get rid of Talmud learning when he wrote this book? He says, this is all you'll need, therefore don't learn Gemara. Or is the Rambam doing this to draw people into learning Gemara?
Yeah.
How do you understand it? Some of the scholars take the Rambam as saying, you don't have to learn Gemara anymore. And some of the Rambam's contemporaries took him that way. Hence, they were opposed. Tversky tries to show that what the Rambam really meant is, you know what? I'm going to show people the beauty of Talmudic logic. And by showing people the beauty of Talmudic logic, they are going to engage in Gemara learning. This is going to whet their appetites. And in fact, there are some letters of the Rambam. When Pinchas Hadayin, whatever he was, wrote a letter of attacks on the Rambam, that, you know what, you're not learning Gemara anymore because of your book. So the Rambam wrote back, you should know, the last 2 years I haven't even taught my book once. All I teach my students is Gemara and Ref. Right? In other words, the Rambam, if you take it as a holistic sense, I think what the Rambam is saying is that, yeah, you'll only need this book, but the Rambam, again, and because of his choice of language, and he's appealing to the common man in as broad an audience as he can, Lashon HaMishnah, Hebrew, right, like we spoke about, so the Rambam is saying, I'm going to whet their appetites and bring them back to traditional Torah learning, to Gemara, etc. Let's just make two other points. The Rambam writes in this Hakdama to the Yad HaChazakah, Bizman hazeh tokfu hatzaros yisir sedoch gasho haskakol v'ov d'choch maschachomeinu binas nivoneinu nistera. Basically, life is brutish, short, difficult, and the only thing, and there's no wisdom anymore. People can't learn Torah. And therefore, the works that the Gaonim wrote are very difficult for us, so I have to write a new book. The Rambam in the Yad HaChazakah is saying the reason why I wrote the book is because there are so many tzaras. People are running from place to place. The Rambam basically has, and Twersky outlines, in his writings there are three different reasons that the Rambam gives for writing his book. One reason is the historical reason. Life is difficult. I have to compose a book so that people running from here, there, and yonder will have a book to access. Reason two that the Rambam wrote his book is a jurisprudential reason. The Rambam feels a need to convey basic Torah knowledge, to give a synopsis of Torah law so that you'll have a text with all the laws. Reason three is the philosophical reasons that the Rambam had, which is he has to convey the true ideas to people. All these three reasons are correct, but I'll just make one last point, and then we'll break. There's so much more to say, but I always do this. My introductions are too long, so I don't have as much time for the six lines from the bottom. The Rambam writes that I broke my book down into different sections, and each section into different laws, so that it will be easy to follow. And he writes, "Kedei sheyeyu sidurim al peh." I'm writing it this way so that people will memorize my text. Now, what does that mean? So it means like this. The Rambam writes in a number of places in the Mora in particular, that he does not believe in written culture. He believes in orality. The Rambam believes that you transmit knowledge appropriately by having a teacher who teaches you and learning in face-to-face interaction.
Yeah.
And text is a bad way to learn. Right? By the way, you could almost hear like the people, you know, fetching, and these little kids today with their computers and their internet and their, you know, InstaChat and what. And like they are just undermining knowledge, and we did it the right way, and we broke our teeth. The Rambam is like, to some extent, pardon, like a crotchety old man, and the Rambam is saying, orality, we should learn. But you know what? There is a certain value that orality is better for retention.
Yeah.
If you want to retain information, hearing it from someone, and Dvarim Sheba'al Peh Iyata Rashai Lakosvam, the Rambam understands, means that you're not allowed to write down Torah Sheba'al Peh because it diminishes Torah Sheba'al Peh. So the Rambam, even though he's writing a text, he chooses to write the text in an easy language so that you can memorize it. And by memorizing it, you can have the advantage of orality. Now, the Rambam also chose not to write in a poetic language. The Rambam hated poetry. The Rambam, by the way, philosophy and poetry are like opposite disciplines, no? Philosophy writes in simple language, but the ideas are profound. Poetry writes in very complicated language sometimes, but the ideas are simple. Right? A poet can write like beautiful words, and the answer is, what's the poem about? Jake is in love. Right? That's the poem. No? Like, oftentimes the words are so beautiful, but the ideas are, right? Philosophy, the words are simple. The Rambam is into simple words, profound ideas. The Rambam hates poetry. The Rambam says that all the people who wrote books on mitzvahs before him wrote poetry, right? He's referring to Ibn Gabirol and all the Azharot and stuff that the Sfaradim say on Shavuos night. And the Rambam says, I don't like poetry. Here. But basically, it's the second paragraph on page 4 where the Rambam talks about how I hate poetry. The Rambam chose to write in very simple language to influence more people as an attack on Karaites, and also, I would say, as a way of showing people the proper way to convey ideas so that you can memorize it. Now, is that true, by the way? I don't know. I think poetry is easier to memorize than prose.
Meter and
right? So, I don't know. But that's what the Rambam is saying. Okay, Chavri, you should have a good night.